All right, so you're here for another deep dive with us, and today we're going to really get into this book, How to Invest in Gold and Silver, with a focus on mining stocks by Don Durrett.
That's D-U-R-R-E-T-T.
Yes, Durrett. And just a heads up, we'll be saying his name a lot, and it's pronounced Durrett, not Durrett.
Yeah, Durrett. It's a good one to get right, especially if you're diving deep into his book, right?
Exactly. Now, this book, it covers a lot of ground, like pretty much everything you'd want to know about getting into precious metals.
It really does, from physical bullion to ETFs, and of course, the company is actually mining the stuff.
But for you guys today, you know, we want to streamline things a bit, so we'll be zeroing in on chapters 6 through 10. This is where Durrett really gets into the nitty-gritty of mining companies.
Yeah, those chapters, they're like the core if you're serious about understanding how to pick potential winners, you know, those companies that might be worth your investment.
So whether you're just starting out or you've been dabbling in mining stocks for a while, this deep dive should give you a solid framework to start making smarter decisions in this sector.
Let's kick things off with chapter 6. This one's all about the big guys, the major mining companies.
All right, the majors. Now, Durrett, he starts this chapter off with this idea of a pyramid of risk in precious metals investing. So where do the majors fit into this pyramid for you?
Well, he puts them right at the base, you know, at the bottom of the pyramid. This basically means they're considered the least risky play in the precious metals world.
Okay, less risky. So for you, does that also mean less potential for big returns compared to, say, those riskier junior miners?
Generally, yeah. You got to remember, these majors are already huge, well-established companies, right? Mm-hmm. They're not going to be doubling or tripling in size overnight. But Durrett, he gives an example. Let's say gold climbs from $2,600 to $3,500 an ounce, which is a pretty decent jump. You might see a 200% return from a major in that scenario.
200%. That's not too shabby at all.
Not bad. Right. But it's probably not going to be the 10-bagger some people dream of chasing in those really early stage juniors.
So you're saying even though they're at the bottom of this risk pyramid, it's not like investing in majors is a guaranteed smooth ride, right?
Yeah.
What kind of problems, what kind of headwinds do these companies run into?
Oh, absolutely. They're not immune to the ups and downs of the market. The biggest one, of course, is the price of gold and silver. If those prices tank, even the giants feel the pain.
Right, because if the price of gold drops below what it costs them to dig it up, they're in trouble.
Exactly. And then you've got all those other external pressures, like energy costs, which are huge for mining operations. Then there's inflation, of course, which eats into everyone's profits.
And let's not forget about those geopolitical risks. Remember what happened with Kinross Gold and their Russian assets last year?
Yeah, Durrett brings that up. They had to sell off their Russian mines at a big loss because of the war in Ukraine. It's a real reminder that no matter how big a company is, world events can really throw a wrench in the works.
Absolutely. So for someone looking at these major miners, what are some key things to consider, you know, before deciding if one's worth investing in?
Well, Durrett, he lays out a whole framework in the book, starting with their producing properties. The first thing, and this is super important, is location.
Yeah, location, 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 right? Not just about how much gold they're pulling out, but where it's coming from.
Right. Durrett calls this location risk, and he uses some parts of Africa as examples, you know, regions where there might be political instability, anti-mining groups gaining traction, even the risk of the government nationalizing those mines.
Basically, the more volatile the region, the more risky it is for the mining company operating there. And that risk trickles down to you as an investor, right?
Precisely. Now, he does say West Africa tends to be a little bit safer overall, but still something to keep in mind. Another biggie he emphasizes is infrastructure.
Infrastructure. Hmm. Now, that might not sound super exciting, but it makes a lot of sense. You need roads, power, water, all that stuff to actually run a mine.
Exactly. And for you as an investor, it's a huge red flag if a potential mine is stuck in the middle of nowhere with no existing infrastructure. Because building all that from scratch, it gets really expensive really quickly.
Especially for those smaller companies that might not have the cash reserves the majors do.
Right. That's why Durrett points out that if a property's close to other operating mines, you know, in a well-established mining district, it's a much better sign because a lot of that infrastructure, it's already there.
Makes sense. Mm-hmm. So beyond just the mines that are up and running, he also talks about, I think, briefly, those properties that are still in development or early exploration, right?
He does, and he points out that those come with a different risk profile, generally a lot higher. And then he moves on to the management team.
Management. That's going to be a big one no matter what kind of company you're looking at.
Huge. Durrett, he really emphasizes the importance of a strong, experienced team, people you can trust. You want to see that they're keeping investors informed, you know, websites that are updated regularly, being transparent about their plans, all that good stuff.
Yeah, if a company isn't even bothering to communicate with their investors, that's probably not a great sign, is it?
Not really. Then Durrett talks about looking at a company's stock price history. He suggests looking for those that might be oversold during those big market corrections, you know, when the whole market takes a dip.
Like trying to find a bargain, basically.
Yeah, kind of. He uses Newmont as an example. You know, it's a major gold stock, and like any stock, it has its ups and downs. So he suggests there might be buying opportunities when the prices drop significantly.
But he also stresses the importance of having an exit plan, right? Knowing when to sell, no matter how good a company looks.
Always. And it's not just about buying low. It's about having conviction in the company, you know, believing in its fundamentals, not just chasing a falling stock.
That's a good point. He also briefly touches on the significance of insiders, you know, the people actually running the company and what their actions tell you.
Yeah, like if they're buying a lot of the company stock, it might signal that they're confident about the future. But if they're selling a lot, well,
it might be a sign to watch out. Now, let's talk about reserves and resources, because this is where things start getting a bit technical. You've got inferred resources, measured and indicated resources, or M&I.
Yeah, all those terms. Basically, you got to know what's what when you're looking at how much gold or silver a company claims to have. So think of inferred resources as the least certain, you know, they're based on limited geological information. It's more like, hey, there might be something valuable here, but we need to drill a lot more to be sure.
So you're saying it's a starting point, not a guarantee.
Right. Now, measured and indicated resources, or M&I, these are much more reliable. They've been verified with a lot more drilling and analysis. Durrett, he gives a general rule of thumb. You can expect around 80% of M&I resources to actually be mineable.
Got it. So for you, when you're looking at a company's potential, you're paying more attention to the M&I, not just the total resources.
Right, absolutely. M&I, that's what gives you a better idea of what they can actually pull out of the ground. Now, after this, Durrett gets into stock valuation, and this part, it's pretty meaty.
Yeah, valuation. We got to talk about that.
Yeah.
He starts with market capitalization. Yeah. Right? That's kind of the basics.
Right. Market cap, it's basically the total value of the company's shares on the stock market. You take the price per share, multiply it by the total number of shares out there, and boom, you've got the market cap.
Simple enough. But then Durrett, he goes way beyond just market cap, right?
Yeah.
He talks about all these other metrics to figure out if a company's actually worth what the market says it is.
Exactly. One of the key ones he talks about is debt coverage. It's a measure of how much debt a company has compared to its free cash flow.
And free cash flow, that's basically the money they have left over after paying all their bills and expenses, right?
Yeah, it's the cash they can actually use to invest in new projects, pay dividends, all that. Now, Durrett, he likes to see a debt coverage ratio of at least 20% and ideally over 50%.
Okay, so the higher that percentage, the better they are at handling their debt.
Right. It means they're not drowning in debt. They have some breathing room. And he even mentions he does a quick mental calculation, sort of in the head assessment, based on their debt, cash reserves, burn rate, and free cash flow.
Burn rate, that's how fast they're spending money, right?
Exactly. And with experience, you can get a feel for a company's financial health without having to do all those super precise calculations every time.
That's interesting. Now, he also talks about cost per ounce, and he's very specific about the difference between cash costs and all-in sustaining costs, or AISC.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that distinction so important for you?
It's all about understanding how profitable a mining operation actually is. Cash costs, that's just the bare minimum, like the direct costs of digging up and processing the gold or silver.
Okay, but AISC, it includes a whole lot more.
Right. Yeah. It does. AISC factors in things like exploration, maintaining the mine, general expenses, the whole shebang. Durrett, he says he even likes to pad the AISC a bit, especially for silver companies, just to be on the safe side.
So you're saying AISC gives you a more realistic picture of how much it actually costs them to produce an ounce of gold or silver.
Exactly. And that helps you figure out how profitable they are or could be under different metal price scenarios.
Got it. Then he gets into this thing called market cap valuation per resource ounce. How does that work?
It's a way to compare a company's market value to the value of the metal they have in the ground. You basically take the market cap and divide it by the total ounces of gold or silver equivalent in their reserves and resources.
Okay, so it's like, is the market valuing the company appropriately based on what they actually own.
Exactly. And Durrett, he suggests producers should have a market cap that's at least 10% or more of their resource value, using the current metal prices, of course. He uses Pan American Silver as an example.
So if their market cap is way lower than that 10%, it might be a sign that they're undervalued.
It could be, especially if you believe the price of gold or silver is going to go up in the future. He also briefly mentions a quick and dirty market cap valuation, where you've just used the resources and current prices to get a rough estimate.
Makes sense.
Hmm?
Then he dives into share structure, talking about fully diluted shares, outstanding options, and outstanding warrants. Can you break that down a bit?
The key takeaway here is dilution. Fully diluted shares include all the shares currently out there, plus any additional shares that could be issued in the future if people holding options and warrants decide to exercise them.
Options and warrants, those are like the right to buy shares at a certain price in the future, right?
Yeah, exactly. So if a company issues a lot of new shares through options or warrants, it can dilute the value of the existing shares. It's like cutting the same pie into more slices.
Got it. He also uses the term tightly held to describe a share structure where there aren't that many shares available for trading.
Right. And that can lead to more volatility in the stock price, you know, bigger swings up and down. After that, Durrett gets into the free cash flow multiple.
Okay, remind us again how you calculate that one.
You take the fully diluted market cap and divide it by the company's free cash flow. Durrett, he says, for quality producers, it's usually around 10 times.
So a lower multiple could mean the company is undervalued.
Potentially, yeah. Especially if you think their free cash flow is going to grow a lot in the future, you know, maybe because of increased production or higher metal prices. And his website, GSD, it often shows current and projected FCF multiples, which can give you a better idea of what to expect down the road.
That's really useful. Now, I know he kind of dismisses some of those more complicated valuation methods that people use for other types of stocks, like the PE ratio.
He does. He prefers these simpler formulas and just keeping a close eye on the overall trend in gold and silver prices. Then he introduces his own preferred valuation method, which is based on estimating future production, future metal prices, and future costs.
Yeah, I like how that method is very forward-looking, you know, not just focused on what they're doing today.
Exactly. It's about trying to project what the company could be worth in the future, not just what it's worth right now. And he uses different multiples, like 5, 10, 15, even 20, to adjust for the perceived quality and risk of the company.
So the more confident you are, the higher the multiple you might use.
Yeah, basically. He also briefly talks about takeovers, you know, when one company buys another. He points out that having a lot of insider ownership can sometimes make a company less attractive for a takeover because those insiders might not want to sell.
Makes sense. And he wraps up the chapter with a whole bunch of resources where you can find more information about major mining companies, websites like Zero Hedge, 321 Gold, The Report, Kitco, all that good stuff.
Yeah, lots of places for you to do your own research and dive deeper. So that was chapter 6, all about the majors. A good foundation, right?
It is. Now, in Chapter 7, he moves on to mid-tier producers, and he calls them the sweet spot. What do you think he means by that?
The sweet spot, for you as an investor, means finding that balance between risk and potential reward. Mid-tiers, they're kind of in the middle, right? They've usually got producing mines, so they're past those really early stage risks, but they still have a lot of room to grow.
Okay, so they're not the giants like Newmont or Barrick, but they're not tiny exploration companies with a drill and a prayer either.
Exactly. They've kind of hit that sweet spot, like he says. And Durrett, he defines mid-tier producers as companies with market caps between $300 million and $1.5 billion, and they're usually producing over 80,000 ounces of gold or 3 million ounces of silver per year.
So not small, but not masses either.
Right. He also talks about emerging mid-tier producers, those companies that are on track to hit those mid-tier levels in the next few years.
So those could be interesting to keep an eye on, you know, those companies that are about to make that jump.
Absolutely. And he even mentions that a lot of pros, you know, experienced investors, they look for companies even smaller, with market caps between $100 million and $300 million. Ah, so they're looking for those companies that are really undervalued, right? The ones that the market hasn't fully caught on to yet.
Exactly. That's where they think some of the biggest potential gains are. But Durrett, he lays out some specific things to look for, like strong management, good mining projects with low costs, favorable locations, all that good stuff.
Sounds familiar, right? A lot of the same stuff we talked about with the majors.
It is. It's just the scale is different. And he gives an example of calculating the free cash flow and the FCF multiple for a mid-tier, saying they should be trading around 8 times their free cash flow, which is lower than the average for the majors.
So potentially more room for growth.
Exactly. And he reminds us again that valuation is all about that market cap and what's driving it, mainly higher metal prices and increased production. And of course, he says rising costs can really hurt.
Makes sense. He also mentioned something called the internal rate of return, or IRR. What is that all about? The IRR, it's a way to measure the profitability of a mining project. It basically tells you what kind of return you can expect on your investment. Durrett, he likes to see an after-tax IRR of at least 25% for a project.
Okay, so the higher the IRR, the better.
Generally, yeah. Then he goes back to that future market cap valuation method we talked about with the majors, and he uses an example. I think it was Aris Mining.
Right. He basically shows how a successful mid-tier producer could see a huge jump in its market cap if they can increase production while the price of gold or silver is going up.
That leverage to rising metal prices, that's what a lot of people are looking for in mining investments.
Makes sense. He also talks about how cash flow will fund growth. What does he mean by that?
He means that these successful mid-tiers, they often use the cash they generate from their existing mines to buy up smaller companies, maybe even junior miners, or to develop their own new projects.
So they're not just relying on raising money from investors all the time. They can use their own profits to expand.
Exactly. And that's how they create real, sustainable growth.
Interesting. Now, the EA makes the point that there aren't actually that many large cap and mid-sized gold and silver producers out there, only about 60 companies total.
Yeah, it's a pretty select group. And that makes those well-managed, undervalued mid-tiers even more valuable because there's not as much competition for investor dollars.
Okay, so finding those gems is key. And that leads us perfectly into Chapter 8, which is all about the junior mining companies. Now, this is where the risk dial gets cranked up, right?
Big time. Junior miners, they're like the high-stakes poker game of the mining world. Huge potential, but also huge risk.
Durrett, he doesn't sugarcoat it either.
He lays it all out. They're typically in the early stages, you know, discovery, drilling, trying to figure out if they've even got something worth mining.
So you're talking about a lot more uncertainty compared to those established producers?
Tons more. He talks about the whole life cycle of a junior, starting with finding that initial mineral deposit, then drilling to see how big and rich it is. If it looks promising, they'll put out a 43-101 report, which basically confirms they've got something.
The 43-101, that's kind of like their stamp of approval from a geologist, right?
Exactly. And then comes a whole series of studies, the PEA, the PFS, and finally the DFS, which stands for Preliminary Economic Assessment, Pre-Feasibility Study, and Definitive Feasibility Study.
Those are basically increasingly detailed analyses to figure out if it makes financial sense to actually build a mine, right?
Right. And Durrett, he points out that this whole process from that initial PEA to actually starting production, it can take at least 5 years and often longer. And all this time, most juniors, they're not exactly flush with cash.
Yeah, they're not generating revenue yet. They're still in the spending phase.
Big time. They're constantly raising money to keep the lights on and keep drilling. And that often means issuing more shares, which leads to dilution. It's one of the biggest risks with junior miners.
Right, because dilution, it can really hurt the value of your existing shares.
For sure. Then Durrett breaks down the different types of junior companies. You've got your straight up exploration companies, small producers, near-term producers, late-stage development companies, those emerging mid-tiers we talked about. And then you've got project generators and royalty and streaming companies.
So a whole bunch of different flavors, basically, with varying levels of risk and potential reward.
Exactly. And he mentions he tends to favor near-term producers because they've generally made more progress and reduced some of the initial exploration risks.
So a bit more balance for you, right? Not quite as risky as those pure exploration plays.
Right. He also talks about how volatile junior mining stocks can be. I mean, their prices can swing wildly based on metal prices, production expectations, dilution, even just rumors sometimes.
Yeah, it's definitely not for the faint of heart. He also warns that the market often prices in a perfect scenario, you know, assuming everything's going to go smoothly.
Which almost never happens in the real world, right?
Exactly. So when those inevitable hiccups happen, the stock price can take a real hit. Then he goes on to rank the overall risk levels of different types of mining companies.
He puts those early stage exploration companies at the extreme end of the spectrum, the majors at the low end, and all the others somewhere in between.
Okay, so for you, the further along a company is in the development process, the lower the risk generally.
Generally, yeah. And then he really emphasizes how crucial the management team is when you're looking at juniors.
Yeah, because with juniors, it's not just about the project, it's about the people running the show.
Huge. Durrett, he even names some well-known mining CEOs with solid track records. Guys like Ross Beaty, Keith Neumeyer, Rob McEwen. He basically says, look for those kinds of experienced, reputable people at the helm.
Makes sense. And he gives a whole checklist of things to look for in a management team.
Yeah.
Experience, track record, how much they dilute the stock, their salaries, how well they promote the company, even their website.
Yeah, he's really thorough about it. It's all about trying to gauge their competence, their integrity, and whether they're aligned with shareholder interests.
Okay, so lots to consider there. Then he dives into those key factors for evaluating junior companies specifically, starting with, again, properties and location.
Right. And a lot of what we talked about with majors, it applies here too.
Oops.
But then he gets into the grade of metals.
Grade. Now that's one of those technical terms that can be a bit confusing.
Basically, grade refers to how much of the valuable metal, like gold or silver, is concentrated in the ore. The higher the grade, the better, generally.
Because higher grade means lower cost to extract the metal, right?
Exactly. But Durrett, he points out that even lower grade deposits can be profitable if they're big enough and the recovery rates are good.
Recovery rates, that's how much of the metal they can actually get out of the ore.
Right. And he even gives some benchmark grades for what's considered high grade for gold and silver for both open pit and underground mines.
Okay, so it's good to have those benchmarks in mind when you're looking at those drill results. And speaking of drill results, those are often what really move the needle for junior mining stocks, right?
Absolutely. Good drill results, they can send a stock soaring, but bad results can tank it just as quickly.
Durrett, he goes into how to interpret those drill results, talking about grams per ton over a certain length, the importance of seeing consistent results in multiple drill holes.
He uses GoldQuest mining as an example, which had those initial great drill results that sent the stock price way up, but then it pulled back significantly. It's a good reminder that early exploration is super risky.
Yeah, you got to see consistent results to really have confidence in a project.
For sure. He also mentions how those drill results are what geologists use to start estimating the total size and grade of a mineral resource.
So those drill results, they're the foundation for everything.
Absolutely. Then he talks about joint ventures, or JVs, which are pretty common in the junior mining world. It's when two or more companies team up to share the risks and costs of developing a project.
So it's like spreading the risk around a bit.
Exactly. But Durrett, he mentions he prefers to see juniors owning at least 70% of their core properties, not giving up too much control.
Makes sense. He also talks about project generator companies, those companies that focus on finding and then optioning out properties to other companies, but he doesn't seem too keen on them.
He says he prefers to wait until they've actually made a significant discovery, not just found a bunch of properties that might have potential.
Okay, so he wants to see some proof before he gets excited.
Exactly. Then he moves on to royalty and streaming companies, which are kind of a different animal altogether.
Yeah, they don't actually operate mines themselves, do they?
No, they provide financing to mining companies in exchange for a share of the future production, usually at a fixed price.
So it's like they're providing the capital up front, and then they get a cut of the profits down the road.
Right. But Durrett, he points out that if metal prices go way up, those royalty and streaming companies, they benefit a lot because they've locked in that lower price.
But the mining company, they might miss out on some of those potential profits.
Exactly. It's a trade-off. And he ends the chapter with a bit of a reality check, saying that most exploration stocks, they're not going to make you rich.
Yeah, that 90% statistic he throws out there, about 90% of junior mining shares ending up worthless, that's pretty sobering.
It is. And he gives an example of a company, Andina Minerals, which was eventually taken over, but not at a price that made early investors a ton of money.
So it's not all sunshine and roses with juniors.
Definitely not. You got to be realistic about the risks. Then he defines what he considers to be flagship property resource targets, really big deposits. And he suggests that waiting until a company hits a market cap of $50 million or $100 million can reduce some of those early stage risks.
So being a little more patient might be a good strategy.
It could be, especially if you're not comfortable with those super high risk, high reward plays.
Okay, let's move on to chapter 9, how to make money in this sector. Now, Durrett, he starts off by saying the most important thing is to actually get in the game.
Yeah. He believes in the long-term potential of gold and silver, so just being invested in the sector, that's a good start.
But he also says the real money is made by finding those undervalued opportunities.
Exactly. It's not just about being in the right asset class. It's about being selective, finding those companies that the market is mispricing.
Makes sense. He also advises starting with lower risk investments if you're new to all this. Things like physical bullion, ETFs, mutual funds.
Yeah, kind of like dipping your toes in the water before you jump in the deep end.
Then he talks about having a buy list and a watch list.
Yeah.
So the buy list, that's for companies you're ready to invest in right now, right?
Right. And you set your preferred entry price for each company so you know exactly when you're going to buy.
Okay, so you're not just chasing price, you're being disciplined. And the watch list, that's for companies you're interested in, but maybe not ready to buy just yet.
Exactly. You're watching them, waiting for a certain trigger, maybe a price drop or some positive news before you pull the trigger.
That's a good way to stay organized and avoid making impulsive decisions, right?
Absolutely. And then he talks about selling strategies, taking profits when a stock has done well, selling if a company gets acquired, things like that.
He also mentions why those traditional trading strategies, you know, using stop losses and taking profits at certain points, those might not work so well for mining stocks.
He says that if you're aiming for those big bagger returns, those multi-hundred percent gains, you got to be willing to ride out the volatility.
So don't panic and sell too early if you believe in the long-term potential of the company.
Exactly. And then he gives a whole bunch of resources where you can find investment ideas like newsletters, websites, social media, podcasts, even forums.
Lots of places for you to do your research. He also briefly talks about actively trading mining stocks, which is a whole other ballgame. And he recommends checking out Mitch Ray on YouTube for that.
Mitch Ray, he's big into technical analysis, which is all about using charts and patterns to try to predict price movements.
Okay, so if you're into that kind of active trading, that's a good resource for you. Then Durrett shares those Paul's rules for investing in PM miners, which are basically a set of really valuable lessons he's learned over the years.
Yeah, those rules, they're gold. Like being patient, focusing on companies with low expenses, looking for insider ownership, backing experienced management teams.
He also says don't get emotionally attached to a particular stock. Don't be afraid to call the CEO if you have questions. Always do your own research. Only invest what you can afford to lose.
Yeah, and he reminds us again that 90% of junior mining shares will probably end up worthless. It's a tough business.
Definitely. And he's got rules about being skeptical of those game-changing ideas, knowing that bringing new mines into production is really hard, and focusing on companies that can be profitable, even if gold prices don't go crazy.
Those are all really important things to keep in mind.
They are. Okay, that brings us to the final chapter we're covering today, Chapter 10, How to Value Mining Stocks.
This is where Durrett lays out his 10-step process for analyzing and valuing mining companies.
So it's like the culmination of everything we've talked about so far, right?
It brings all those concepts and metrics together in a structured way.
Okay, let's walk through those 10 steps for you guys. The first one is all about future reserves, understanding the different categories of resources, like inferred, M&I, and P&P reserves.
He emphasizes looking at the MRE, which stands for Mineral Resource Estimate.
Right. Step two is location, assessing the political and other risks associated with where the company's projects are located. He talks about that risk ranking again, from safest to most extreme.
And how important it is to be in a mining-friendly jurisdiction, you know, a country that supports mining.
Step three is share structure. Understanding the potential for dilution from outstanding options and warrants, and watching out for those reverse stock splits, which can be a red flag.
Step four is management, which we've talked about a lot. You got to have a good team in place, especially for those producers.